Aristocracies don't last because the children of aristocrats grow up as pampered beings, or the grandchildren do, and then aristocracy turns into oligarchy, that is, rule by the few only for the few, only concerned with themselves. And when that happens, the people get discontented because they are not being taken care of by the elite that's running society. And in that situation, there emerges from the elite someone who believes that he can take the masses into his protection and ride to power on their anger.
A conversation on how the ancient historians would see our political world today. Our guest is Arthur Eckstein, professor of ancient Rome at the University of Maryland. He joins us next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Turkish crime scene investigators entered the residence of the Saudi consul general in Istanbul today to search for evidence in the disappearance of Saudi writer Jamal Khashoggi. The Turkish forensics team entered the residence as a pro-government newspaper published a gruesome recounting of his alleged murder in the Saudi consulate. The media is reporting that Khashoggi was dragged screaming from the consul general's office, forced onto a table in a neighboring room, and injected with an unknown substance. The report says Khashoggi was then dismembered by a Saudi forensic doctor and autopsy expert while he was still breathing. The newspaper said the Saudi consul general could be heard on the tape telling those torturing Khashoggi, "Do this outside, you're going to get me in trouble." The newspaper said one of them replied, "Shut up if you want to live when you return to Saudi Arabia." Turkish state media report the consul general left Turkey yesterday, presumably to return to Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is returning home after a visit to both the Saudi kingdom and Turkey. After meeting with the Saudi king and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Pompeo remained positive about the purported Saudi probe into what happened to Khashoggi.
They made a commitment to hold anyone connected to any wrongdoing that may be found accountable for that, whether they are a senior officer or official. They promised accountability for each of those persons whom they determine as a result of their investigation deserves accountability.
Including a member of the royal family?
They made no exceptions to who they would hold accountable.
President Trump criticized the allegations against the Saudi kingdom. He compared them to the accusations of sexual assault leveled against now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Trump told the Associated Press, quote, "Here we go again with your guilty until proven innocent." A caravan of about 2,000 Honduran immigrants and refugees is on the road in Guatemala again. They're hoping to reach the U.S. despite President Trump's threat to cut off aid to Central American countries that don't stop them. Here's one caravan member.
In Honduras, Trump has a corrupt government. It should sanction Honduras for condemning these people to misery, for forcing them to live in a situation of violence. And Trump has a corrupt government, a usurper who took part in a colossal fraud. The Honduran government knows this perfectly well. They who have murdered people on the street, a criminal government supported by Trump, provokes this migration.
The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights called on Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico to respect the rights and ensure the safety of the Hondurans traveling in the caravan. United Nations Special Envoy Staffan de Mistura said he will be making an intensive effort to get agreement on a committee to draft a new constitution for Syria. That's before he steps down at the end of November. De Mistura announced he's departing for purely personal reasons after 4 years and 4 months in one of the toughest UN jobs. He made the announcement after telling the Security Council that objections by the Syrian government are holding up the launch of the committee that is to draft a new constitution. Canada has become the second country in the world to legalize the recreational use of marijuana. Canadians lined up to buy marijuana as the sales began today. Bill Blair is Canadian Minister of Border Security and Organized Crime Reduction. He said legalization would protect Canadian children.
We know from experience that the criminal prohibition that was in effect for a century in this country has failed our kids and our communities. It has led to a situation in which our children use cannabis currently at the highest rate of any country in the world. And additionally, we also know that the current, up until today, the market for cannabis was entirely controlled by organized crime.
A Canadian official said the country also will pardon all those with convictions for possessing up to 30 grams of marijuana, which is the now legal threshold. Uruguay was the first nation to legalize marijuana. A rocket fired from Gaza destroyed a home in southern Israel earlier this morning. A mother and her three children had fled their home to a shelter after warning sirens sounded. They weren't injured but were being treated for shock. The Israeli military began attacking what it identified as militant sites in Gaza with 20 airstrikes. The Gaza Health Ministry said a 25-year-old Palestinian fighter was killed. Eight other people were wounded, including six children on their way to school. An Oregon federal judge has ruled that a climate change lawsuit filed by a group of young people can go forward. The Trump administration had asked the court to put it on hold. A group of 21 young people filed suit in 2015. They argue the federal government's actions violate their constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property. And they say the federal government has violated its obligation to hold certain natural resources in trust for future generations. The case is set to get underway on October 29th. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. A grand lesson of history is that no system, empire, or republic, government lasts forever. By definition, history does not tell us when current systems will fall, but it does show us how previous systems fell, and we can glean from them what we will. Today, we're going to look at both the fall of the Roman Republic and then later the empire, and compare it to our political times today in U.S. history. For that conversation, very happy to welcome back to our radio station, Arthur Eckstein. Arthur Eckstein is a professor of history and distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland at College Park. He is the author of a number of books, including Moral Vision and the Histories of Polybius. His most recent book is called Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. In fact, we had Art Eckstein on to talk about that book just a few weeks ago. And
that's
then we
right.
kept talking
that's
because
right.
you are a professor of the Roman ancient Roman
yeah.
history. We had another conversation and then I was like, well, let's do
how
this
did this
again.
Happen?
How did this happen? That's yeah. exactly how it happened.
It was pure luck, folks.
That's right. Good to see you again. Thank you for
Good.
Coming back.
Good. I'm very glad to be here, Mitch.
I want to quote from an article that you recently wrote that was published in a book called Chaos in the Liberal Order. And your article is called Aristocracy, Oligarchy, and Trump. You say this, quote, "It is clear that Thucydides and Plato, Polybius and Sallust would have been appalled at Donald Trump. But what I have sought to show here is that they would not have been surprised. The Trump phenomenon was familiar to them. They had a vivid awareness of the fragility of free states when the traditional limits on political behavior were broken by a ruthless demagogue emerging from within the existing elite." Tell me more about that.
The ancients believed, ancient political writers believed that the achievement of states where people had rights and where the legitimacy of the government was based on voting, not on the gods or something like that, that those states were fragile. They thought that there were three kinds of states, ruled by one man, would be men too, that's monarchy, which had an evil twin.
All of
tyranny.
These have evil twins,
yes.
right? We'll get to those. So,
yeah.
so monarchy has an evil twin.
Tyranny.
Tyranny.
Aristocracy, which is what we're going to be talking about, ruled by a few, had an evil twin, oligarchy. And democracy, which was also good, had an evil twin, mob rule. In terms of aristocracy, they said an aristocracy is a place where the elite run things pretty much, but they are public-spirited and are concerned with the community.
The word aristocrat, if I recall correctly, actually means of the best.
Rule by the best.
Yeah.
Right.
Not of the richest.
No.
But of the best.
The most virtuous.
Meaning.
Yeah. Of course, that's how aristocracies always see themselves.
Yes,
yeah. So, and I think the American aristocracy saw itself that way. I mean, all those Yaleys who went into the CIA, I mean, all of that, they thought they were being virtuous after World War II. But the ancients thought that aristocracies don't last because the children of aristocrats grow up as pampered beings, or the grandchildren do, and then aristocracy turns into oligarchy, that is, rule by the few only for the few, only concerned with themselves. And when that happens, the people get discontented because they are not being taken care of by the elite that's running society. And in that situation, there emerges from the elite someone who believes that he can take the masses into his protection and ride to power on their anger. And such a person they call the demagogue. And, you know, Donald Trump fits this perfectly. Or anyway, pretty well. I mean, he's from the elite, he was a billionaire, or so he says, and yet he says to he says he speaks for the working class, especially the white working class. And it's clear that the white working class, or maybe a lot more than the white working class, were discontented with the establishment. You know, 112 counties that voted for Obama twice voted for Trump.
Yeah, It's amazing.
6 million people who voted for President Obama. Obama voted for Trump. They wanted something other than what they were being offered by the establishment and the established elite. They wanted a newer choice. But Obama wasn't a demagogue, but Trump really is. And so when I say that none of the ancient political writers would have been surprised at this, I think that they were looking at what caused the collapse of free states. And what's interesting about it is, sure, they blame the demagogue, but what they really do is blame the characteristics of the elite. That is, they offer a deep social reason for why these people emerge, which is that the elite has abandoned the interests of the people.
It's fascinating when you explain the shift from an aristocracy originally, meaning I think we have a different kind of idea when we say aristocrat today.
Yeah.
But originally a shift from aristocracy to oligarchy, and then that sets up the conditions of people being upset about the conditions that leads to the rise of somebody from the aristocratic class, from the upper class.
A renegade aristocrat.
And then, you know, takes on the cloak of the outsider representing the people, the demagogue.
Right.
Of course, I was thinking right there with you, like, oh, my goodness, that sounds just like Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Tell me, in the ancient world, is there a figure like that?
Caesar is a really good example of that. Caesar is a fascinating character, obviously, Gaius Julius Caesar, but he is somebody who, unlike Trump, was a war hero. I mean, he got the equivalent of the Congressional Merit of Medal of Honor when he was 20, saving people's lives. He wasn't a draft dodger. Of course, I was a draft dodger, but I admit it. You know? but he also, in the face of opposition from an established oligarchy, which he thought, that is the Roman Senate, which he thought were only taking care of themselves and were not listening to the complaints of the people, he then rides to power on their support and then arranges to have this huge command where he conquers what's now modern France.
The town called Gaul.
Gaul, yeah.
And Great Britain, too, even though he didn't really
stay. He tried.
Yeah, he got there, but he didn't stay.
Yeah. Which he crossed the Rhine into Germany, too. I mean, he had – there are no limits to his ambitions. And that
– He killed.
Millions.
Responsible for millions.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, some people say it's funny.
No.
You think – not funny, yeah. But I mean just interesting in the sense of, you know, Hitler – somebody like Hitler is still so fresh in our mind. What happens when you're separated by, 2,000 years?
Yeah. I mean,
and that might be –
that all of those deaths were done with swords and spears and arrows and face to face, not with machine guns or bombing. I mean, it's really something. The ancients counted up how many people he claimed to have killed, and it was 1,192,000. And
in a world that's probably not nearly as populated as
that's right.
The 20th century.
It's a real Holocaust. And what's even more amazing
it
about
it is a Holocaust.
It is.
It
was.
It's a European Holocaust.
Yeah, it was. And you can see why people back in Rome, seeing what's going on in Gaul, in modern France, might go, what is this guy going to be like when he comes back?
And he's off away for quite some time.
Oh,
you
he
don't
was
go that far
8 years.
Return in a day.
Eight years. Yeah, I mean, he essentially was king of Gaul for 8 years.
What's the situation with the Republic then during this period?
Elections are still going on. He has influence over them. He has allies who help bring friendly public officials to the elections. The Romans have elections every year. It's that was because they feared kings. So they had very strict term limits of for the leading public office. The consulship was 1 year. What Caesar did, and what others were doing in this what's called the late Republic, was arrange to have multi-year large commands from the people, voted by the people. And the reason was, when you have rotation in office like that, it's very hard to deal with events far away. I mean, it's going to take somebody 6 months to get where he is. So there was a need to have these multi-year, multi-provincial, large commands in order to deal with the problems of Roman success, which was the empire. If you look at a map, you can see that the empire is huge. But for the Romans, it's five times bigger than it is for us because of transportation primitiveness. So they really – there was a need to have somebody who could be out there a long time. Caesar arranged as champion of the people, which also involved – this was in 59 B.C. Arranged land redistribution to the poor, things like that. And they
canceled debt for the
canceled,
poor.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an occurrence. Isn't it a reoccurring situation in the late Republic for, say, the last 100 years or so? I mean, you go back to the Gracchi brothers.
Yeah. The problem actually, the large problem in Italy is the growth of large estates, which were caused by the fact that the small farmer who was the backbone of the Roman army, it's one thing if you're fighting in Italy for 6 weeks in the summer, but it's another thing if you have to go to Spain and you're away for 6 years. Then your farm falls into decrepitude because the main laborer is gone in the army, and it was a draft army at that point. So that what you then get is people return, and they've been ruined by defending the state. You know, it's a little bit like all the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans or the National Guard people were called up time after time so that their lives are financially ruined. So they were demanding a new deal, and especially because people who came back sold their farms in order to get out of debt, but then they don't have farms, and then they drift into the city so that Rome becomes a city surrounded by slums. The capital of the world becomes surrounded by slums inhabited by the people who made the empire.
And that's just making income. I mean, that's the definition of income inequality. They're selling their farms to the people that already own all the land, and so –
Oh, yes. I mean, the income inequality in the late Republic is astounding. And one of the things Sallust says, you know, he says, houses the size of cities are being built. And that is true. We actually have a map of Rome from that period with lots of little higgly-piggly streets. And then there's somebody's estate in the city, which is the size of five city blocks.
Yeah.
And those people are living, and people can see how what's going on. So the income disparity is terrible. I should say how that was eventually handled was that the young Octavian, who became the Emperor Augustus, settled people, new people, poor people on the land by force in 42, 41, 40 BC. He confiscated private property and gave it to the deserving, actually veterans who had fought. And, you know, that actually handled the problem. In the first century AD, Italy is actually a land of small farms. But how it was done was by violence, by saying, okay, this is what's going to happen. Get off the land you have. Here comes the soldier and his friends, and you are through as the owner of this place.
And that's really interesting to me, because Augustus is he takes over. He becomes emperor after Caesar is killed.
Right.
And so we're jumping ahead a little bit. We'll get back to Caesar to complete this story. But that's interesting to me, because I think in the ethos of our own culture here, think, well, democracy is always the best, especially for regular people, for poor people. But history would show, and if you have a monarch, or let's just say even a dictator, you can have a really bad dictator. But you also find that oftentimes dictators will be friendlier, more compassionate maybe. That might not even be the right term. But more beneficial to poor people than, say, the aristocratic class ever would be.
Augustus certainly was. Octavian certainly was. And Caesar intended to be himself. Let's go back to Caesar, though. I mean, the thing is, but his ambitions were viewed as unlimited, and that's what created distrust back in Rome about what he was doing. And I think they were unlimited. To give you two examples, once the Civil War starts, he's 52 years old. He's balding 52-year-old guy with a teenaged mistress who is also the Queen of Egypt. That is Cleopatra. People looked at that and said, what's this? Where is the limits to his appetite? It's not just ambition. It becomes appetite that's involved in it. And so you have writers, political thinkers saying it's appetite that's the problem. And that if you have people with a great deal of power who are oligarchs and only interested in themselves, that appetite shows up first in feasting and food, then in sex, where it's unlimited what they want to do. No restrictions, no limits, and then it's power. So, I mean, you look at Trump, who is supposedly 1 pound short of being officially obese. As for his sexual drive, we've all had to deal with this ad nauseum. And so when people look at that now, they go, this guy has no limits. Right? Republics run on limits, limits on behavior, what you can say, what you can do. People didn't believe that Caesar was going to accept any limits to his power after he'd conquered Gaul. I mean, he became his private fortune by the end of the Gallic conquest was the size of the Roman treasury. And we're not talking about Bill Gates, who's got $100 billion. We're talking about somebody who has $2 trillion. So you can see why people worried about him, you know, that he had no limits.
Yeah, I want to ask you a question, and that is the Roman Republic. Is it democratic? Do people vote?
People vote, but one has to – it's a modulated, complicated thing. People are elected by they are elected by an electoral college. Where the rich vote first. And there are 193 voting units, and 98 of them belong to the rich. So if the rich all vote for one person, that person automatically has a majority vote of the units, and then there's no need to continue asking other people to be counted.
That's what happened. It just stopped with the upper... The aristocrats.
If they were united, the reason I want to make it complex is there were often many candidates running. There could be as many as 6 or 7 candidates running for the consulship, the presidency, in 1 year. And so you could never know how things were actually going to come out. But it's certainly heavily weighted towards the rich, towards property owners. And the mob, the masses, got one vote, even though they were a majority of the population. Nevertheless, aristocrats and oligarchs had to learn public speaking. And the only reason to do that is because they actually had to convince people to vote for them. And it could happen that very aristocratic people lost.
And that's why oratory is so important.
That's right. That's the mark of a free state. Oratory, The importance of it is the mark of a free state. It's not a frozen waste. It's very complicated politics. Cicero actually wrote a pamphlet called How to Get Elected, which we have, and it's really complicated. Who you have to talk to, who you have to schmooze with, who you have to butter up, all of these things to get elected.
We're in a conversation with Arthur Eckstein, professor of history and distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland at College Park, author of a number of books, including Moral Vision and the Histories of Polybius. That's your guy, right, Polybius? We'll talk about him in a moment. His latest book is called Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. He's also author of an article that does pertain to the conversation that we're having right now. It's called Aristocracy, Oligarchy, and Trump. The reason I ask if the Roman Republic was democratic, if people voted, and it kind of goes back to a previous question I had, and that is sometimes a dictator or even authoritarian, strong-armed ruler, a monarch, whatever you want to call it, may sometimes be more beneficial towards poor people than a democracy would. And the reason that Caesar was killed – I mean this is the popular telling of the story anyways – is because he was about to upset the cart, the apple cart for the aristocrats.
Yes, that's true. And one of the things to think about is of the conspirators, half had opposed him in the Civil War and had been pardoned by him. And you would say, and people did say, how ungrateful of them to kill him. To which the answer is, these are people who are used to pardoning people. They're not used to being pardoned. They're used to making it on their own. But the other half of the conspirators, including the leading military person, had supported Caesar in the Civil War. They were people who thought he'd had a case, but they didn't want the Republic destroyed, and Caesar was showing himself to be a person without limits, including having his statue carried with the 12 gods in ceremonies. Or being declared a dictator was actually a constitutional office in Rome.
That's right. Lasted for 6 months.
It's
like an emergency office, right?
Absolutely.
We need someone in here to call the shots, to deal with a very important situation.
And then you step down.
Yeah.
It's 6 months or the end of the crisis, whichever comes first. And it was a great amount of trust to entrust somebody with the great powers that the dictator have because they're trusting him to step down and not to be seduced by it. But Caesar was made dictator without time limit. At first, he was made dictator for 10 years, not 6 months, and then he was made dictator without time limit, and that was in February of 44, and he's dead the next month. So people worried that he was going to end free politics. And is that politics free and democratic? It is in a way. There are multiple candidates for office, but they're all from the same class.
Yeah.
So you can vote. You can vote for Clinton, or you can vote for Rockefeller, or you can vote for Bush. I mean, this is one of the things that happened in 2016. People did not want to see a Clinton versus Bush, although a Roman would have said, "Of course, that's how things are. That's what you see in every election."
Talked to Paul Cartledge several months ago,
the
classicist on Greece, ancient Greece, and he wrote in a book on democracy that democracies tend to historically favor the aristocrats.
Because they're a known quantity. We know how Roman electoral speeches went, and people had to give speeches in which they would say, "You know me."
And they have the
fellow
time.
Citizens.
They have the time to do it. They have to pursue office. They have the money to do it.
Oh, yeah. Office is unpaid.
Yeah.
Right there, you're limiting who's going to be able to run. It's an honor. It's called an honor. And it's an honor without money attached. Of course, if you go out and slaughter some people, you can get some loot. But it's unpaid. But, I mean, the way that those election speeches ran was, you know me, my father conquered the A's. My grandfather conquered the B's. My great-grandfather conquered the C's. You know what you're getting if you vote for me. And that was name recognition was a very powerful thing. So every Kennedy and Bush and Clinton and Michelle Obama, too, would have that benefit of name recognition of people who knew what the family had done. It was difficult for people to vote for unknowns.
So they stopped Caesar.
Yes.
Including people who once supported him,
that's
correct?
Right. That's right. That's right.
But they couldn't stop the end of the Republic moving into an empire. Well, what does empire even mean in this sense? Because Rome had mostly already expanded.
That's right.
As an imperial force.
Oh, yes. Most of the Roman Empire was conquered under the Republic.
Under the Republic. I mean, I said that before, too, with Paul Cartledge. Is that it's kind of interesting to see how ancient and maybe even modern democratic systems or republics, how quarrelsome they can be. Because same thing with ancient Greece.
Oh, they're very
expanded
quarrelsome.
As through – they voted for their imperial expansion.
Oh,
but what does
Athenians
it mean
didn't.
To become an empire then if it's already owning these territories?
The original meaning of the word imperialism had to do with internal dictatorship. The emperors, starting with Augustus, were called Imperator Caesar, and Imperator just means successful general or victorious general. So into the 19th century, the term imperialism referred to somebody like Napoleon, who was emperor of the French. He was guilty of imperialism, which did not have to do with expansion. Then in the 1870s, imperialism came to mean people who supported the idea that Queen Victoria should be Empress of India. And that's how it gets attached to colonialism and that kind of expansion and begins to be used to mean expansion, especially overseas of any state. Even in 1877, 1878, the person who was the colonial secretary in the British government said, "Imperialism, what is that? This is a new term to me." Hmm. So, but now it does mean unnatural expansion, I guess, and empires, the creation of empires. And I think people want to say, well, empires are bad. But I'm sitting here with Mitch, who seems to be saying, well, you know, empires can be good.
Oh, thanks, Art.
I just thought you that, that's
what you're referring
to. It's a controversial position.
And I'm not trying to say empires are good or not, but I guess when you say that, I'm referring to the ancient meaning of empire, where, again, a strong-armed dictator, a monarch, whoever it is.
Right.
And it could depend. You know, you can have somebody like Caligula or Commodus, you know, or Nero, or you can have someone like Marcus Aurelius or Hadrian.
Let me give you an example from Commodus. Yeah. You know, he wasn't like the guy in Gladiator. He was a hardworking guy. One of the things the emperor had to do was to answer petitions from people who were asking for redress of grievances, asking the dictator to intervene because they're powerful and can do it. And we have a document but from tenant farmers on an imperial estate in North Africa who have written directly to the emperor saying the bailiff on the estate is taking too much of the crops. We only signed up to give him 20% and he's taking 30%. And actually that means he's ripping you off as well. We want you to correct the situation so that we're not starving. And we have the document and underneath it, it says in Latin, I have read it. That's Commodus saying, so here's the emperor. We like to think of him as a bad guy. He's answering the petitions of small, poor tenant farmers, and he's saying, fix it to his government. Get rid of those guys. So
good.
Yeah.
So my point.
Yeah.
So my point is not that empire is good, but I again, in the old sense of empire, but I'm just pointing out that there are times, there are conditions where an empire benefited the poor more than perhaps it would under a democratic system. I'm not saying that's what we should go for.
No, yeah. I know you're not. I know you're not.
But that's something just to be aware of.
It's because dictatorships can be efficient and get things done.
And a dictator may have to need the support of the people
to
counter the threat by the aristocratic, the landowning class.
And this was one of the things one can see the popular pressure on emperors. Caesar offended many people because at the games, which he attended to show he's one of the people, But he was a very busy guy, so he was sitting in his box seat answering letters. And the people were angry at that. They said, you should be watching the gladiatorial fights with the rest of us. And so he stopped, you know, doing that. So people can have an impact on him. I think it's fair to say that efficiency is the argument that dictators usually give, you know, that the Roman Republic, like the American Republic, is really slow and complicated. The Senate was very loath to make any decisions. It was inefficient and incompetent to run a large empire. It was a city council. It's like asking the city council of San Francisco or Berkeley to run the United States. And so to run the empire, you have to give power to people, but the more to do special things. And the more power you give people, then they say, well, how are you going to get them to come back? You know, how are you going to get them to come back once they've experienced this? People thought this would happen with MacArthur, who'd been out in the Far East for 15 years and had been absolute ruler of Japan for 5 years. Truman recalls him, and people worry, is he going to come back? Or how is he going to come back? And yet he was necessary to be out there to fix these imperial problems.
And just to try to ward off any potential emails that are probably coming my way now, I do recognize terrible dictators ranging from Mussolini and Hitler to, you know, you can go up and down and you know, Franco and find people that were also terrible.
Right. Augustus learned from Caesar not to appear so overtly a dictator. So he took the title First Citizen or Speaker of the House. And he never appeared in the Senate wearing armor. He always wore a toga. He made a point of greeting fellow senators by name and saying, oh, don't get up. On the other hand, under the toga, he was wearing armor to prevent assassination. Yeah. So that's the nature of his regime. It's a two-faced regime in which he proclaimed the restoration of the Republic with a guy.
And that was the thing. When we look back now and we see a republic ending and an empire beginning, no one at that point necessarily saw it that way. It's much easier to look back. I mean, they still had – you saw the Senate.
Yeah.
I guess you saw the tribunes.
Yes. I mean, they're all working. All that stuff is still going on.
All those
Senate meets, elections occur. Yeah.
Exist.
Yeah. Yes. And, of course, the people who run for office – and there can be multiple people running for office – they're all friends of Augustus. And – he worked very hard to reconcile those who had opposed him, as Caesar had done, who had opposed him in the war. And it's quite amazing. He could have killed them all, but he doesn't. He wants them because he needs an aristocracy to run the empire. He can't do it himself. The Senate, you need generals, you need lawyers, you need diplomats, you need administrators, and those, in the way the Romans thought, could only come from the Senate. So he had to deal with them. The emperorship, if you want to use that term, was a schizoid institution. In Rome, he cannot appear as a total dictator. Outside of Rome, all the statues show him wearing armor or naked, which was the other thing. The Greeks liked that. It's called heroic nudity. You get that as well. So he had to be both. Octavian was able to do it. Caesar was not. Caesar's unlimited appetites were clear to everybody, and one of the reasons he was killed was he was leaving to go conquer the Iranians and would be gone for a long time, and his regime would be settling in while he was gone. So they wanted to kill him for that reason too. But I would say about this, the level of distrust that's created by people not accepting limits on their behavior can wreck a republic. The republic depends on, for instance, if you lose the election, you lose the election. That's all that happens. You're not threatened with being imprisoned. When Trump did that to Clinton, threatening her with imprisonment, this was a violation of the limits on behavior that had been established for 250 years, that you don't do that.
You don't see that as Trump being Trump. That's what Trump says. Can't take anything that guy says seriously.
Thucydides, writing 2,500 years ago,
said, he's the Greek historian.
Greek historian said, on the island of Corfu, a debate in the assembly before the people on whether to ally with Athens or not ends with one side winning. The other side then takes the winners to court on various trumped-up charges and fails to convict them. So then those people take their opponents to court and does convict them, and then the opponents assassinate those who had won the victory in court. So you have political debate in the assembly, division, leads to use of the courts, the weaponizing of the courts against your enemies. And Thucydides says this is how things collapse. So when Trump said that, I went, oh, my God. You know, Thucydides would go, I've been here before. I've seen this myself. And here's where it's going to end up.
And Thucydides saw the end of democracy.
In Athens.
In Athens.
Did, yeah. Although it was restored. So,
yes, it was.
By violence. By violence. And those people were heroes, the people who restored them. Democracy were ordinary people who did that. But I think, again, the issue becomes distrust, and republics need trust. I know I'm gabbling on, but I can give you two separate sets of information. Since 1992, every American president has been viewed as illegitimately elected by one group or another. Bill Clinton was viewed as illegitimately elected because Ross Perot took 20% of the vote from Bush Sr., who would then have won. Bush Jr. in 2000 was illegitimately elected because of he actually lost the election in popular vote, and then there was the terrible business with Florida. It says, President Obama was considered illegitimately elected by people who thought he'd been born in Kenya and therefore legally could not be president. And Trump was elected, and there are lots of people who say he's illegitimately elected because Clinton won by 3 million popular votes. So we have now had a sequence since 25 years where some large group within the American population views the government as illegitimate, either from the left or from the right. That's very bad for the republic. That creates polarization, creates splits, creates people not only differing politically but beginning to hate each other and feel they're being cheated or somebody is cheating. So that's one fact. How things used to work is this way. Bill Clinton beat Robert Dole for president in 1996. And after the election, Clinton invited Dole to the White House and said, I know you're interested in the issue of refugees in the Balkans. I want to make you the president's special representative on refugees in the Balkans, and I'll give you one of the Air Force Two, whatever it is. And Dole said, okay, I'll do it. He was interviewed on, I hate to say, a station which shall not be named. And the interviewer says, what are you doing working for Clinton? He beat you. And Dole, who's a representative of the greatest generation, the generation that won World War II and then also defeated the Soviet Union, he says to the interviewer, the president of the United States was my political opponent. He was not my personal enemy. After the election, he asked me to do something for the country. I agreed to do it. What the hell's wrong with you?
He said that? What's wrong with you?
And
Bob Dole said that?
Yeah. And he's had a bad temper.
Okay.
And that person, the interviewer, is the voice of the future.
Yep.
There are very few people like Bob Dole anymore. I'm not that I voted for Dole, I can assure you. But this is people who accept limits and cooperation as the essence of the republic.
We are in conversation with Arthur Eckstein, professor of history and distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland at College Park. He is a professor of history of the ancient Roman world. He's the author of a number of books. His latest book, which is not on this topic, but we had him on about a month ago to talk about it, is called Bad Moon Rising, How the Weather Underground Beat the FBI and Lost the Revolution. He also has an article that came out recently in a book called Chaos in the Liberal Order, called Aristocracy, Oligarchy, and Trump. So here we are in this situation right now, and I think it's pretty remarkable, and I'm curious if you see parallels at any time in the ancient world where you have what seems like government entities going after each other. Maybe this is related to what you were talking about with Corsica and the threatening or even the imprisoning of your political opponents. But,
right.
You know, you see what's happening in the House Intelligence Committee against the FBI, the Trump against the FBI, but you see how Democrats are responding, you see how the FBI is responding. And almost I'm getting the sense, not that these were perfect. I mean, I was on Capitol Hill 10 years ago covering congressional hearings almost every day, but I've never seen what really seems like – and maybe we got this during the McCarthy era – but just the pure weaponization of these entities.
I agree, Mitch. I've never seen anything like this either. Even in 1968, or maybe in 1968, but not since 1968, 69, it is a distrust in the institutions. And it means the reason for that distrust, certainly being weaponized by Trump, is that those institutions are not responding quickly enough to the needs of the population as the population sees it. And the Senate in Rome, there used to be no alternative to the Senate. So people went along with them being clumsy and slow. Then people began saying, well, the Greeks have alternatives to this kind of republic. One of them is somebody who's given a lot of power to get things done quickly. And after 133, after the Gracchi, who were saying, we can have land reform. We don't have to wait for the Senate to vote on it, because they never will, because they're large landowners. They don't want reform. I, the tribune, Tiberius Gracchus, will offer you land, state-owned land, so that you can get back on the countryside and have small farms again. Once that happens, once there's an alternative, then people are looking at alternatives to senatorial rule. That undermines the Senate, which had, up to then, had such enormous prestige that people listened to it. But now people are saying, well, who are those guys in the Senate? They're just rich guys who don't care about us. And, of course, if you look at the American Senate, how many are millionaires? You know, in the House.
Not all.
But many, many are, yeah. So people look at
that. But so the Gracchi's, then that's how we end up getting the Tribune of the Plebs.
Right.
And we say Tribune. It's interesting. The word a newspaper will call itself a Tribune.
Well, you know what their position
Oakland,
is.
The Oakland, we have a Tribune building still. Unfortunately, doesn't have a paper.
Yeah.
But that said, Tribune was to be sort of the protector, the voice of the people.
He was the protector of the people. 10 were elected every year by the people. They could not be from the old patrician aristocracy. They had to be plebeians. Their house had to be unlocked and the door open 24 hours a day in case somebody needed help. And originally their purpose was if there was an unfair court proceeding going on, they could interpose their bodies and say, I forbid this from happening. And the word for that is veto. So the tribunes could veto judicial judgments, but eventually they could veto the Senate. And they could stop all government activity on the grounds that it's harming the people.
And that would happen.
Oh, it did happen, yeah.
And so where government, and this will sound familiar today too, comes to a complete stop, and then what we end up getting is violence.
Right.
And mob violence.
In the 130s, tribunes, there was a war going on in Spain and there was conscription and people didn't want to go. And the consuls, the two consuls, were ordering people to go. The tribunes came up to them and took them to jail. So this was a balance where they are really supposed to be protectors of the people. But what was going on is people had accepted that the rule of the Senate meant things happened slowly and not very efficiently, although eventually things got done. People accepted that. After the Gracchi, they don't, because there are alternatives to getting things done really quickly.
It doesn't sound like those things are bad things.
They weren't. No, I mean, the issue, I mean, again, if you go back to what the ancient political thinker says, demagogues don't come out of nowhere. They come out of specific social economic situations in which the people are not being cared for by the elite. And that's when you get a renegade from the elite who claims to speak for the people, who's usually only after himself, but they can do very good things as well, because if they get power, they're exercising it. So, I mean, this is people, the ancient writers would say, we know who this guy is. We know who Trump is. We've seen him before.
I want to quote your article, Aristocracy, yeah. Oligarchy, and Trump, one last time. And this is when you are writing about Roman Republic turning into the empire.
Yeah.
You say this, quote, "It can be argued that American Republic has followed a similar pattern. Since the 1930s and 40s, presidential power has continually expanded, especially in foreign affairs, no matter which person or which party was in the White House."
That's right.
So this isn't just Trump.
No. What Trump is doing is using the powers that President Obama used when he couldn't get things through Congress because there was gridlock. So he was doing things on the basis of presidential decree. And I'm glad for the things he did, but it would have been better if he'd taken it through Congress and gotten actual legislation, because everybody knew that if the next president was a Republican, they could reverse all of these presidential actions, and that's exactly what has happened. It's just people always assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to win, so there would be no problem using this. But I mean, the president is the person who can start an atomic war. That wasn't true in the 1930s. The last time...
You look at presidential powers, too.
Yes.
And having had declared wars, starting with the Korean War all the way up to every war since.
The last time...
I mean, this is Congress. I mean, you could say Obama, but this was right. Also a product...
of a spineless Congress.
Dating from the Korean War.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, the Constitution says only Congress has the right to declare war. The last time that happened was 1941. That's 70 years ago. Every war fought since then has been fought at presidential initiative only. I mean, the closest it came was the first Gulf War in 1990, where the Congress authorized the president to do what was necessary. But that wasn't a declaration of war either. Bush, too, didn't bother with that. Obama didn't bother with that when they started bombing Libya or fighting ISIS. And Trump certainly doesn't either. So can a republic manage a worldwide empire? Or does the necessity of giving great power to individuals in order to get things done individually create a danger?
There may be a listener or two who might be listening to us and thinking, well, yeah, it's the Roman Empire, right? That's ancient Rome. Why should that matter for us? And I think you've laid it out. But it's also, I think, worth pointing out that the quote-unquote founders – the people who wrote Declaration of Independence, including Thomas Jefferson, the people who were participating in the Constitutional Convention, these people were all students.
Absolutely.
Of the classics.
They were. Polybius has a volume where he describes the Roman Republic as it existed in his time, which was about 150 BC, and he calls it a mixed constitution of three co-equal branches of government, each balancing the other. Well, Tom Jefferson read that at William and Mary when he was there in the 1750s. When Jefferson was in Paris, he writes to I think it was John Adams and says, "Hey, there's a new edition of Polybius out. Do you want me to send it to you?" So these things. That was the model that they had, and it was supposed to be a mixed constitution. But the model comes as a poison pill because the republic eventually fell after 500 years.
Which is a good long time.
It is
a good long time. Double our time. Almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean the American republic has lasted almost 250 years. George Washington didn't think that would happen. George Washington, also steeped in the classics, said, if we're lucky, the American Republic will last three generations until it's totally corrupt and falls apart. Well, he said that in about 1790. If you count three generations, you end up at 1860.
Hmm. And the Civil War.
And the Civil War, yeah. So the founders had a sense of the fragility of the republics. I think we're used to not thinking of that, that they could fall apart. But they can through distrust, through unlimited appetite, through claims of efficiency.
And when we talk about the power of Congress,
yeah,
and Congress abdicating really of that power, I think we both agree with that. And that is probably just as much of a threat to a republic than, say, a Donald Trump.
They're not doing their duty.
And in that, there were philosophers from we call quote unquote Enlightenment period that were that you know the United States, people will say along with slavery and everything that it had, but it was still a product of the Enlightenment,
right?
In which Enlightenment thinkers were like people like Montesquieu were studying the ancient republics and democracies and trying to figure out how can we make a system that doesn't go down the same path they did. With Montesquieu, we get the checks and balances in which a Congress as a co-equal branch of government is vital.
So we now have a situation where the courts are going to be loaded in the Republicans' favor. Congress right now has a Republican majority, both in the House and the Senate. And then you have the presidency in the hands of someone who has unlimited appetite. One way to handle it is to make sure that the Democrats win in the midterms, at least win the House, so that there's at least one branch to balance the power. Right now it's unbalanced. And
about Alice Walker, prolific writer, global activist. Whether she's urging us to preserve this vexed paradise or to simply stay conscious of the importance of beauty, Alice is always encouraging us to honor the divine in each of our souls. On Thursday evening, October 18th, starting 7:30, she will be at First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way in Berkeley. She'll read from Taking the Arrow Out of the Heart, her new book of poems, printed in both English and Spanish, to express her love and all sane peoples of both people, both cultures. Nina Serrano, poet, writer, and KPFA host, will appear with Alice. This KPFA benefit is wheelchair accessible. Tickets available at brownpapertickets.com or supportive independent bookstores. Treat your inner self. Hear Alice Walker with Nina Serrano, October 18th.
KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org.
And the time is 11 a.m. Stay tuned next for the Talkies.